Up next, an interview with Skylab 4 astronaut Ed Gibson.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
If the truth were known, we really delayed this launch so we could get the burritos on time.
I figured that.
The flight director says get back in.
We lost the flight plan out the window.
On all three networks, you replaced all the kitty cartoons.
Houston, we've had a problem.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
I was rolling on the moon one day.
Counter, go and throttle up.
Go and throttle up. The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
You're listening to The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.
An interview with Skylab 4 astronaut Ed Gibson. This is Rich Kirshner reporting. We're speaking with retired Skylab 4 science pilot Ed Gibson. Doctor, how's this conversation finding you in good health?
Oh yeah, very good health. I'm working on a book, so I'm very active and enjoying it.
How did you become an astronaut?
I always wanted to fly high-performance airplanes as a kid, but I had osteomyelitis as a kid, and when I tried to think about getting into the flight program and the service, I found out that I was disqualified because of the osteomyelitis. That's what kept Mickey Mantle out of the service. So I decided, well, if I can't fly them, I'll go build them. So I went off to college and got a degree in engineering, and then went off to graduate school at Caltech and got a degree in engineering and physics, specializing in jet propulsion and rocketry. About a year out of the program, out of graduate school, my wife and I were sitting in Los Angeles, and she started reading me an article in the Los Angeles Times about how NASA was looking for scientists who wanted to fly high-performance airplanes and fly in space. So I thought, that's kind of interesting. So I thought about it, and it would certainly be a drastic career change and require a whole bunch of new skills, really a sharp change in direction of where I was going. So after we debated about it a long time, I applied at 7:30 that morning. For 9 long months, NASA labored over the birth of this new group of scientist astronauts. They're not test pilots. The first three groups were all test pilots. And they finally concluded that in all that time, in all of the United States, they can only find 6 healthy scientists, semi-healthy scientists, and I happen to be one of them. So I was in the right place at the right time and loved it.
The Skylab 4 crew were all space rookies. How did you get selected for that flight?
Well, it was kind of process of elimination. When we got in the program, there was 6 of us who were in the science side of it, Skylab, or science astronauts. 2 people left the program. Jack Schmidt flew on the last Apollo mission to the moon. So there was 3 of us left, and there were 3 Skylab missions. I was the most junior of the 3, so they put me on the last mission because that one had the greatest risk of not flying. However, as luck would have it, it did fly, and so I got the best mission of all. It was the longest one.
How would you describe the ride up to the Skylab laboratory?
Well, let's see, right up. You know, you practice this so many times, and it's like, well, just taking the elevator up to the top of a very tall building, laying in that spacecraft, waiting for something to go, and you go through all the procedures. And finally, one day when you do that, someone down outside counts down and you get to 0 and the bottom floor of the building explodes and off you go. At first, the G's are not too much, but you do feel like the bottom floor of that building just literally went out from underneath you. Then at around 1 minute in the flight, you go through the maximum G's in acceleration and you feel your cheeks and ears have slid to the back of your head. Then off you go and finally you get to staging, which feels like John Young called it a great train wreck. Feels like a head-on collision, quickly followed by a second impact from the rear. Then you get on the second stage, and that's just like one smooth elevator ride where you accelerate ever faster as the massive propellers burn away. Eventually, you weigh around 5 times your normal weight, which is not bad because your heart's at the same elevation as your head, so you don't tend to gray out or pass out. But you do notice that your cheeks and ears have slid to the back of your head. Then in a little over 8 minutes, the engines cut off sharply, and immediately everything floats. It's all a lot of dirt and debris that's been hiding underneath the couches comes up and floats in the cabin till the airflow finally moves out of sight. Glance out the window, and there's Kurt horizon and the Atlantic Ocean. And then, what seems only a matter of minutes, when you look out again, there's Italy sliding underneath. So now you know what it's like to be traveling over Earth at 5 miles per second.
Now, I've never heard of the term gray out.
Oh, well, that's where the blood, if you were sitting upright and with those G's, the blood would drain from the back, from your head, and you'd lose that from your eyes as well. So your retinas would not function as well. And you, as we've seen in flying high-performance airplanes, if you're not wearing a G-suit, it will gray out. The world around you will narrow down to a point. And if you continue, you'll eventually lose sight. But as soon as you let blood flow back into your head, the sight returns.
Now, you lived in a space station that was damaged during launch and then partially repaired during the Skylab 2 mission, releasing the remaining solar wing after the second one was torn off during launch and they established power to the laboratory. Did you have enough power for lighting, heating, communications, and all of your different experiments, or did the mission plan have to be altered?
No, I'm sure it was altered some, but as far as we were concerned, we had all the power we needed. The first crew went up there and repaired that station, got the one remaining solar panel up and running, and that turned out to be sufficient for them as well as the next two missions. They did a great job and really saved the program and gave us our opportunity.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with retired Skylab 4 science pilot Ed Gibson. How would you describe the interior size of the Skylab? Was it crowded, and what were the sleeping conditions like?
Well, let's see. In terms of size, we have one large volume, which is 22 feet in diameter. We were inside of the hydrogen tank of an unused Saturn S4B, so it was pretty large. You know, you could float around quite easily in that. And then we had other compartments, multiple docking adapter and a few other things that where we could be in many different places. One day, the crew lost me. The other two guys lost me because I was turned out I was behind a refrigerator looking for some of the what had the previous crew had left over in their data. So they searched around for a little while. They were calling, and I guess let them look for me. Eventually, they found me. So it was pretty large in there.
That's funny.
Yeah. One time I tried sleeping at night in that large volume. Let's go back to the sleeping compartment itself. We each had our own sleeping compartment, and that consisted of a little bit of padding and then some a little blanket and some straps that went over our body and were slightly elastic. And when you close your eyes and put your head against the padding, you can imagine you were laying in a bed at home. And you go right to sleep. We had no trouble sleeping whatsoever at night. At least I certainly did, and I don't think the other two did either. But one night I tried floating free out there in that large volume. I figured, hey, this is the best opportunity to float around and never have bed sores when you wake up in the morning. So I tried that, and it worked great until I would slowly drift into a wall. And then I come off that wall very slowly, and my mind would think, okay, that's over. But it's going to happen again. So you never go to sleep quite asleep that way. You're always waiting for the next slow impact. So but all you had to do is just tuck an arm or a leg over something, underneath something to feel stable, and you go right to sleep. No problem.
I was speaking with John McBride one time. He was on Challenger, and he mentioned the astronaut Marc Garneau. He was the first Canadian astronaut to go up with our space program, and he said that he would like to just float freely, as you were just saying, and John would wake up in the middle of his sleep, and he'd be floating right in front of him, just like you say, drifting a little bit, and just going wall to and scared the heck out of him, you know? I can you imagine, you know, waking up, and all of a sudden there's a crew patch getting, you know, right by your nose.
Right by your nose, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I have to ask, how was the food, and were you able to warm it?
Our food was actually pretty good. You looked at what they had on the previous programs, Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, and a lot of that was tubes and cubes, not very appetizing. But because we were NASA's very expensive laboratory animals, we were part of a mineral balance experiment, which meant that our food was controlled. Six minerals that went into us and six minerals that came out of us, which we measured both going in and coming out. And I won't go through the details of the latter.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
but because they were very careful with food, the food was extremely good. We had to suffer with things like lobster Newberg and filet mignon and those types of things. Had ice cream. We had a little food tray where we could put things which were cold. We could have water or drinks which were in an accordion type of thing. So that which was our coffee or lemonade or whatever we chose. And then we also had warm things, as I mentioned, some of the meats and other things. So I could not complain about the food at all. I think they did a great job.
What were your primary duties on the station?
Well, I was had the science background, and I made sure that I was going to get a seat on that station because of one of the major things they did was solar physics, on studying the sun. And that was one of the three major efforts. The other two were understanding what happens to the human body and long-duration space flight, which Dirk Kerwin, being the doctor on the first mission, handled that one. And then we also did a lot of Earth observations, which we all took part in and really enjoyed. But I made sure I was going to get a seat on Skylab, so I specialized in solar physics, wrote a textbook on the subject, and did a lot of work on the solar telescopes, which really revolutionized our understanding of the sun, because we were able to look at the sun any time we chose that we were in daylight, and see the high energy processes on the sun, the configuration of the magnetic field and all that. Even look at the corona, the region around the sun that we normally have to wait until a solar eclipse would go to the top of a mountaintop and finally look at it that way. So we had real opportunities. And the other two guys, of course, took their turn working on it, but I was principally the guy in charge of that, and just loved it all. It was a great challenge.
You performed three spacewalks. I'm sure that when you left the hatch, you had an emotional and visual rush. Please share those experiences with us.
Yeah. You know, when you're inside the space station and you're floating, everything seems across. That is, there's no up or down, no left, right, really. It's just everything is across. So as long as you've got a control panel in front of you that visually is oriented up and down in front of your face, you can work with it. But when you go outside and you're floating, of course, just as you were inside, and you just push off and move away from the station, then all of a sudden you look down and there's Earth, you know, 270 miles down, and you don't feel or see anything else around you. Your natural instinct comes up, hey, I'm going to fall. So your heart quickens a little bit, and then you smile and you realize what's going on, and laugh at yourself and get back to work.
What were you required to do during those spacewalks?
Well, the spacewalks were originally designed to replace film in the solar telescopes. This was way back in yesteryear, you know, almost back in the caveman days when we didn't have computers that recorded every piece of data. So they were used to recording things on film. So that's what we did. And we had to go out and replace the film in those solar telescopes three times during our mission. And that was what it was designed for. Now, we thought that was going to take a long time when we first started developing that. And so the spacewalks were planned up to 6 hours, or in some cases even more. But we got that work done in about 40 minutes. And the rest of the time we spent repair work, repairing all kinds of things that were broken outside. And we had our share of things to work on. So our spacewalks were pretty busy.
Now, I had a question from a fellow reader for this show, and she wanted to know, this is a good one, you're going to enjoy this one. During an EVA, or a spacewalk, I should say, I know all these terms, most of our listeners probably don't, but during a spacewalk, what happens if you get an itch?
Well, you do have an itch, and that's where it stays, right there. you don't have any way to get to it. You know, when you're sleeping at night, you feel a little itchy and actually go scratch it and go right back to sleep. But when you're out there in a spacesuit, you learn to live with it. Take your mind. I don't recall that was ever really a problem. I mean, I recall you had some, but you just put it out of your mind and went on. And for a little while, you're okay.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with Skylab 4 science pilot Ed Gibson. As the last crew ever to see the Skylab, what were your thoughts as you departed the laboratory?
Well, we didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know whether we were going to have more American crews come up to it someday, or maybe the Russians would visit it. So we didn't lock the doors on the way out. You know, we closed them, but they could be opened by people who knew how to do it. And we'd hope that it would be used again. Unfortunately, it came down before we really thought it would, and it was never used again. We had hoped that we'd have another crew go up there and at least boost it higher so it could be used further, maybe as a nucleus for our next space station. But unfortunately, the shuttle funding was delayed, so it was not ready in time. And the atmosphere of the Earth was moved up a little bit higher because the solar activity was higher than anticipated. So there was more drag on the spacecraft, and it came down. So in 1979, it sure enough came down and scattered parts all over Western Australia and the ocean.
Well, after 84 weightless days on orbit in a sterile environment, you splashed down in the Pacific. What were your impressions as the hatch was opened and you were taken to the recovery ship and walking for the first time in so long?
Yeah, that was a real experience. We felt all right when we landed and we're laying on our backs, but when we had to climb out of the spacecraft, that was different because all of a sudden all the blood, which at first when we launched had gone from our toes to our head, now it had reversed, and we had lost 3 pounds of water in flight just because our upper body was gorged with blood, so it was natural for the body to eliminate some fluid. So we lost around 3 pounds of water, but when we came back, all the blood headed back towards our toes, and we felt faint. Fortunately, we were wearing G-suits around the bottom part of our legs like a fighter pilot would, and that kept us from losing much blood from our head, so we didn't pass out. But we noticed it was hard to lift the hand, and it was a little difficult. We understood that immediately stepping out of the spacecraft and crumpling to the deck of the carrier was not good public relations. So we very carefully walked, and it took a while. You know, it took about 3 days before you felt good walking again. For example, the best way I can describe it is you walk with your feet wide apart, very slow, hesitating steps, like you were coming home from a party late Friday night. After 3 days or so of that slowly going away, you felt pretty good. But then it took about another 2 weeks in total where our testing on a balance beam showed that we had gotten our total balance back. That worked out well. I made the mistake, dummy me. When I first got back, I was back for about 5 days, and I went out and ran 5 miles like I was used to doing before I flew, and every joint in my body just ached for days. So the joints were not used to all that pounding, so it took a little while to get that back in shape.
What were your emotions when the Skylab station came down from orbit and disintegrated?
Oh, I was just disappointed that it couldn't be used further. As I said, as a nucleus for our next station, and there was not much on the horizon before then, so to go further. But eventually, President Reagan came along and made sure that we got a space station and a shuttle program going, and we did get another space station up there, but it was probably a little bit later than I anticipated.
After you left NASA, what adventures did you get yourself into?
Well, when I left NASA, I was still interested in the space program, so I went to work for a few companies that were doing work in the space arena, which was enjoyable. One thing I really enjoyed was I worked with Neil Hutchinson, who was a flight controller, and we started our own business. And I went off to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where they had a lot of Earth resources data stored there. We did a lot of work there, and I was in charge of about 300 people, which was fun as in terms of a management job. And also, I've done some writing. I wrote two novels, and now I'm busy writing another one, which describes the whole space program called America in Space. And I've enjoyed the writing as well as public speaking, so I've kept busy, kept off the street corners.
Will there be an audiobook available of the latest book that you're writing?
I do not know whether there'll be an audiobook. I'm looking for an agent right now. I've gotten the book written and gone through several iterations of making it as good as it can be. I'm just this week looking for a good agent when they get it published. And if they want an audiobook, I'd be glad to do it, or they can have someone else do it. My daughter, who's very skilled at this, she's done audiobooks before for other authors, so who knows what'll happen.
Okay, well, this was actually the most proper venue to ask you that question.
Yeah, I understand, and I appreciate the interest of all those out there who are not able to see visually what we've been doing, but I'm sure that they got much keener senses on hearing and their other senses to determine a lot about what our world is really about. So I just wish them all the best.
You now reside in the great state of Arizona. I have the most important question for you that I ask of all of our guests. Okay? You're not going to get out of this one either.
Okay.
What's your favorite food, and what do you want for Christmas?
What's my favorite food? Well, you know, on Skylab, we enjoyed the filet mignon and lobster Newberg and ice cream and all that. But there was one thing that we all had up there, all three flights, which was something called empty calories. It gave us some energy, but it didn't have any of those minerals in it that we talked about, so it didn't disrupt any of the studies. And those things were butter cookies. I loved butter cookies. And that became, everybody else did, too, so it became the Skylab monetary unit. And, they were limited, and that, so we traded butter cookies for everything we did, and I just love them still to this day.
Now, what's your favorite food on Earth?
On Earth? Oh, I like things like buttered popcorn and, I don't know, let's see. We have a pork shop nearby that's got pulled pork, which is very good. Those are the types of things. Ice cream, I can very easily live on hot fudge sundaes, but I would gain around 200 pounds, so I can't do that very often.
Alan Bean told me once, his answer was pasta. He loved spaghetti. And he said since college, he would have a bowl of spaghetti every day.
Well, I'm sure he almost did when we knew him. He used to love to go to Elmo's down there in Florida, which was a very good Italian restaurant. He had some form of pasta. As a matter of fact, his family joked to us that the day that he died, he was ordering pasta. So he had it right up to the end.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's Alan.
That's Alan, yeah. We love the guy. He was a great guy.
All right, you're not going to get out of the second part of the question. What do you want for Christmas?
What do I want for Christmas? I'd like to see America get busy in space again. I'm writing about it now, so I'm reflecting on all of what we've accomplished. And it really had to do with the vision, courage, and commitment of two different presidents. President Kennedy, who got us to the moon, and then President Reagan came along and made sure that the space shuttle and the space station got going and got through the development phases, which was the high end or the high spending phases of the program. And I'd love to see us get going on something again. However, there's also something that's happened that we didn't have then. This 1,000-pound gorilla has ambled onto the field called commercial space. So now we got space companies like SpaceX and others, which are greatly reducing the cost of spaceflight. We've got these aggressive guys in the commercial arena doing the best that American enterprise can offer, and we're getting back into the space in a big way. It's happening gradually, so you don't really notice it. It's not like all of a sudden launch into the moon, but it's taking a great effect in. I hope that we get back into space, and we just started. After all, when you think about what we've done, it's been 50 years since we ever got off outside the Earth's environment and gone to the moon. we should be going back to the moon and then on to Mars. There's so much to learn, so much to explore, so much to utilize. And unfortunately, a lot of people, politicians especially, have had their eyes on their shoes and failed to look again up at the horizon. But I think that's beginning to happen. And what I'd just love to see is we get an aggressive space program and get back busy doing the things that do good for us and stimulate our education, our technology, and all of our economy. All the things that we got out of the Apollo program are all there waiting for us to take advantage of again. It just requires vision, courage, and commitment on the part of leadership.
Well, there's so many benefits that we received from the space program. Even when I was a kid, I was born in 1963, so things were already underway and things were already being invented and manufactured for the regular Joe Q public, everybody else in the States and around the world for that matter. And it was a result of the space program.
Sure. And I think one of the best things that came out of that in Apollo was the lighting of the human torch, as we call it. Kids got interested in space. It became all of a sudden math, science, engineering, and other technologies became exciting, and they influenced what courses they took, what careers they went into. And as these new highly capable, enthusiastic graduates fanned out into a wide range of different pursuits, all those pursuits benefited, and we saw a great jump in our technological capability over those years. And obviously that would have happened without the space program, but not at the rate and in the expansive manner that it did, driven by the demands of spaceflight. And I'd like to see that happen again. In terms of our technology, we've only started. We're just in our infancy. What we ought to do is look forward and compare it to where we can be. We got a ways to go.
Doctor, thank you so much for sharing of your experience. It's a pleasure getting history from the bold adventurers and sharing it with our listeners. From Sun Sounds of Arizona, Godspeed in all of your endeavors. An interview with Skylab 4 astronaut Ed Gibson. This is Rich Kirshner reporting.
From the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, and God bless all of you on the good Earth.
This has been The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.